you for listening to the Performance Anxiety Podcast on the Pantheon Podcast Network. I am your host, Mark, and this is a really cool episode. My guest today is Mike Leonard. He plays guitar for the Magnolias, but that's not what we're discussing today. Almost 30 years ago, Mike was in a band called the Bleeding Hearts with Bob Stinson of the Replacements. Mike tells me how he got into music and how the Bleeding Hearts formed. He also tells me about how he got Bob to join the band. It wasn't exactly easy, but once he did, Bob went all in, including moving in with Mike. That, in part, led to the band getting time in the studio and label interest. But soon after the sessions were over, trouble started brewing. Mike talks about all of this and why it took 29 years for the album to come out. Check out the album Riches to Rags on Bar None Records, especially if you like straight-up rock and roll. Pick it up from Bar None or wherever you get music. There may still be some vinyl left. Follow us at Performance ANX on Instagram and Twitter. Rate, review, and support the show through merch at performanceanx.threadless.com or ko-fi.com/performanceanxiety. And check out all the other great shows on the Pantheon Podcast Network. Let's not keep you waiting anymore for Mike Leonard of the Bleeding Hearts on Performance Anxiety.
Sure. Okay. All right. Rolling. Hey, this is Mike Leonard. Hey, this is Mike Leonard. I'm on Performance Anxiety. I'm with the Bleeding Hearts and the Magnolias. We have the Bleeding Hearts record, Riches to Rags, coming out. So go out to your local record store and pick it up. 30 years in the making.
Well, thank you so much for doing this. I really appreciate you coming on.
Yeah, my pleasure. I've been listening to the podcast. So.
Oh, cool.
Listened to another one today, actually. So, yeah, it's very cool.
Oh, man, thank you. I appreciate you checking it out.
Yeah.
Been very fortunate with this thing. I've had some amazing folks on, so I'm very, very, very blessed. But you're one of the more unique ones, because I think this is the first time I've had a guest on whose album is coming out 30 years after you recorded it.
Yeah.
That's unusual. So
buried treasure. Yeah.
And I want to find out how you got to that point and how we came to a 30 year delay in the release. So what I want to find out is really how music made an impact on you in the beginning. Was there music in the house? Were your parents musical, or was it something that you discovered on your own?
Well, yeah, it's kind of, I would say it was more something I discovered on my own when I was really little, like, I don't know, probably 5 or 6. I remember seeing the show came on TV in the mid 70s called The Roots of Rock and Roll.
Okay.
And, so that was kind of like the first exposure to it, like seeing Elvis and Rolling Stones and stuff like that. And one scene that kind of stuck out to me was I've searched for this scene, like to find it, like on YouTube ever since. I've never seen it again, but I can still remember it from when I was a little kid. They show Mick Jagger and he says, "The best Rolling Stones caused madness." And then I remember I was watching it with my parents, and like right after Mick Jagger said that, I looked at my dad and my dad said, "I don't like him." And then it was just like, it was just like, boom, you know.
Now I love him.
I have to know everything about this guy. Yeah.
That's the best way to get into a kid's heart is to make your parents hate them. That came out wrong. Right. The best way for an artist to get to the kids is to have the parents hate them. I think that's what I was trying to say. So the Stones were a big, an early favorite for you then.
Yeah, I forget how that worked. It was like the first record I ever bought was an Elvis Presley record. Okay. I think it was easier to get my parents to buy in on that, because my mom actually had been an Elvis fan in college and had seen Elvis in concert like in 59.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so I was able to kind of talk her into letting me buy an Elvis record, you know, when I was, I was like first grade or something. Nice. So yeah, I went through a little Elvis phase, and then the Monkees and, you know, that kind of thing. Oh. Watching the Monkees, you know, was a big thing.
Yes, I love the monkeys.
Yeah. Well, then let's see. When we moved, I new neighborhood. It was went through a Beach Boys phase, and then discovered Kiss, and that kind of took me all the way up through sixth grade, I think. And that my first concert was seeing Kiss, like in '79.
Wow.
On their Dynasty tour.
Oh man.
Yeah.
Man, for your parents not liking the Rolling Stones and going to see your Kiss concert's pretty good.
Right.
Man. So when
that was the kiss of death, though, as I remember, like when I bought Dynasty the day it came out, and my mom let me play it on my dad's nice stereo. And I remember my mom saying she liked that record better because it had more of that disco feel. And I was just like, oh, this is awful.
Oh,
as soon as the parents start to like it, you know, then it's like time to move on to something.
Yeah, exactly. That's the death knell. Jeez. And then bring disco into it. Man, yeah. That was like salt in the wound. Man.
Yeah.
So when did you start playing instruments? Was guitar the first instrument that you played?
Yeah, I pretty much guitar. I wanted to play guitar. I had taken some rudimentary piano lessons with my sister. It was funny. We kind of like signed up for these piano lessons from, seemed like it was kind of like a snake oil salesman, pretending to be a piano teacher. And we went like two or three times and, you know, we kind of show our mom what he was teaching us. And it was just like, I don't think this guy's a real piano teacher. So, So that's about as far as I went with formal piano training. And then I was able to talk my parents into letting me start guitar. And I wanted to play electric guitar. We went to the Schmidt Music and they were talking to the people there and we recommend that he starts on acoustic guitar. And it's like, it made no sense to me because, you know, like acoustic guitar, it's got a thicker neck than an electric guitar. I mean, for a little kid, it would be easier really to play electric guitar, but
yeah,
I kind of started out, you know, doing the acoustic guitar, learning like folk songs and stuff like that. I remember like learning like Scarborough Fair.
Oh, wow.
Like that. But, and then finally got an electric guitar though. Then a few years later, I must've been like, seventh grade or sixth or seventh grade, started playing electric. Yeah.
When did you start playing in bands?
I started probably just kind of jamming with people in junior high, like eighth grade ish, okay. Eighth, ninth grade. Yeah. You know, I would not really a formal band until a couple of years later, but just a lot of basement jamming.
Yeah. And this is, and you're from like the Minneapolis area then, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So that's,
yeah, suburb of Edina.
You had a whole bunch of Minneapolis punk bands to draw from.
Yeah. And one of my pals in high school, his older brother was already kind of playing in bands in Minneapolis. And so we kind of peered into that life through him. He was in a band called Bad Trip, and we were kind of sharing the same basement with his older brother, and would see those guys practice from time to time. And I think they might have even played like with the Replacements a few times.
Oh wow!
And that's kind of how we learned about those cool bands like, you know, the Replacements and Husker Du and
yeah,
and Suicide Commandos and
yeah, you
know, Curtis A. Yeah.
So how old were you when you actually started going out and playing gigs?
18, 19. I was in the first band I was ever in that played an official gig it was a band called Midwest Pop Experience.
Oh, wow.
We played the 7th Street. Yeah. And we played the 7th Street Entry on a new band night. And it was, you know, kind of me and some guys I met at a cooking job. You know, I worked in the kitchen for like 10 years out of high school.
Oh, wow.
So that was the first taste of it, you know, playing the 7th Street Entry. And, but then, you know, shortly after that didn't last very long. And shortly after that, me and my high school pal, Bob Herbers, we're kind of set out on starting our own band again. And that eventually evolved into the Bleeding Hearts, after a couple of years and several lineup changes.
Okay. We'll be right back after a word from our sponsors. This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp. Without a healthy mind, being truly happy and at peace is hard. The good news is therapy works. But what is therapy exactly? It's whatever you want it to be. Maybe you're not feeling motivated right now and would like some tools to help. Or maybe you're feeling insecure in relationships or at work, not dealing well with the stress. Whatever you need, it's time to stop being ashamed of normal human struggles and start feeling better because you deserve to be happy. And now you don't have to worry about finding an in-person therapist near you to help. BetterHelp is customized online therapy that offers video, phone, and even live chat sessions with your therapist, so you don't have to see anyone on camera if you don't want to. It's much more affordable than in-person therapy, and you can start communicating with your therapist in under 48 hours. Try doing that in person. So join the millions of people who are seeing what online therapy is really about. It's always a good time to invest in yourself because you are your greatest asset. And a special offer to Performance Anxiety listeners, you can get 10% off your first month of professional therapy at betterhelp.com/performanceanxiety. That's betterhelp.com/performanceanxiety. Thanks again to BetterHelp for sponsoring this podcast. So the recording version, that's Bob Herbers and Rob Rebello. Was Rob one of the original members, or was he one of the guys that they cycled in a little later on?
Actually, on the record, it's not Bob Herbers. It's Pat McKenna.
Okay.
So Pat McKenna joined the band after Bob Stinson joined the band. And Rob Rebello, who's on the record, he was actually kind of an original member. It was funny because it's kind of hard to keep track of all this stuff from like 30 years ago. But yeah. He was actually from Hawaii, and he moved to Hawaii for a while. So he was in the band when we started it. And then he left. And he moved to Hawaii for a while, and I think he recently reminded me that I called him and said, you know, we got Bob Stinson in the band. Now you got to come back, you know. And so eventually he came back he moved back to Minneapolis from Hawaii and, you know, rejoined the band. And
wow. That's dedication.
Bob Stinson. Yeah. Yeah. He left Hawaii to play with Bob Stinson.
Yeah. To go back to Minneapolis, man, that's some dedication. So how did you meet up with Bob Stinson and start playing with him?
Well, let's see. So shortly after I moved to Uptown, probably like early 90s, like 1990, or it might have been 91. And I lived just down the street from the Uptown Bar. So I kind of started hanging out there quite frequently. And Bob Stinson, you know, was a regular there. His mother, Anita, was at work there. Okay. In the daytime. And so I just started, you know, I started seeing Bob all the time, and became acquaintances. He's like 10 years older than me. So I was kind of like this, you know, sort of, I don't know. I might have been like an annoying kid to him at first, you know, when I first started talking to him. But So yeah, we the Bleeding Hearts were playing, you know, already and had already played Gates Out of Town. You know, we're, you know, okay, we've been going for a while, and the guitar player that had been playing with us kind of abruptly left.
Oh.
And you know, kind of like a light bulb went off. It's like, I should get Bob Stinson to play guitar for, you know. And so I approached Bob, and by this point, you know, we had a little bit of a rapport at that point. And I was pitching the idea of him playing with us, and you know, he was kind of reluctant at first, and we eventually were able to kind of drag him down to the practice space to try playing with us. And the first time we got together, it didn't kind of click right away. He kept suggesting that we get this other guy to play guitar. He thought would be perfect for our band.
Oh man.
And we were like, no, Bob, we want you, you know? after like 45 minutes of chaos, you know, at the practice space, we were kind of like, okay, who is this guy you're telling him? You know, like maybe we should take Bob's advice. And so we did. And we ended up, he introduced us to this other guitar player, and he ended up joining the band for about 9 months.
Oh, wow.
And so he was great. And at that particular guy actually moved into my apartment as well. And he, you know, he kind of took over my couch for about 9 months. And he decided to move to San Diego. So suddenly we needed a guitar player again. And I think at that point, Bob had seen us a few times. And at this point, Bob, you know, wanted to play with us. And he was like, you should have me play guitar. And I was like, okay, well. And so he, at that point, he kind of made an effort to try to prove himself, you know, after the last time didn't go so great.
Oh, wow.
And he came over to my apartment, and he was, you know, kind of determined. He like learned all the songs in like one night, you know, basically.
Oh my
gosh. Went through every tune, and you know, he could be like, you know, he played, you know, by ear, and you know, he was pretty sharp when he was on, you know, like he could pick things up really quick. So, and yeah, I think he suggested then, shortly after, you know, he was officially joining the band, I think it was his idea to move into my apartment. he was living in his mom's basement at the time. So
oh, wow.
I think shortly after that, I helped him move his stuff out of his mom's basement and over to my apartment. And yeah, that's when it started.
Had he left the replacements when you guys were playing the first time?
Yeah, okay. So this would have been, so he left the replacements in what, 86?
Yeah, I can't remember.
I was like 86.
Okay.
And this would have been like 91. So, you know, this would have been like 5 years later.
Oh, okay.
And he had been in Model Prisoner, I think was the first band he was in post replacements.
Right. Okay. Right. Yeah.
With Sonny. And then he was, had a band called Static Taxi for a few years.
Yes.
And he was actually, you know what? I saw him play with Static Taxi once or twice. I can't remember. I saw them at the Caboose, and I went down there, and it was like he got me in, and it was like back in the early 90s, bars used to just give liquor away, you know. it was like a kegger at the bar.
You
get there at the beginning of the night, and they give you a plastic cup like you're at a kegger, and it was like free refills the entire night.
Oh my God.
I remember I got pretty inebriated that night.
That's when you fell in love with Static Taxi.
Yeah, so that's when I saw him, you know, and then shortly after that, I think that ended.
Mm-hmm.
So I think when he finally joined the Bleeding Hearts, I don't think he had any other bands he was playing with at that moment.
Okay. Well, I think you've stumbled upon the two recipes to get kids to love your band. Either get their parents to hate you or get you drunk. That's the magic formula right there. One of those two things has to happen.
So, yeah. Yeah.
I'm trying to figure out how to timeline is going with this. Bleeding Hearts is, you guys are playing with Bob live. You guys are gigging at this point before the recording sessions took place, right?
Yeah. So this the timeline would basically be like, I think he joined in late 91. So like 91, 92. And then the spring of 93 was when we went to go make the record at Terrarium. So,
okay.
So we did the first session in March, and I think we recorded like 8 songs that appear on the record. And then around that time, we got the opportunity to play with his brother Tommy's band, Bastion Pop.
Okay.
Yeah, so that was probably beginning of 93 as well. Probably around the time that I'm guessing around March of 93, something like that. And that is also when Spin Magazine came out to do the story about Bob and like kind of, okay, where is he now kind of story. And so we, you know, so Charles Aaron flew out. He was at the Bash and Pop show, and you know, he interviewed Bob and me at the CC Club, and then he got together with Bob, with just him and Bob, one or two times more, and that's when Bob kind of said some things to him that like got in the article that kind of tanked the article.
Is that the article that kind of got you the recording session though? Was it Sunshine Dunham from Fiasco, right?
Right.
How did that whole thing come about?
Yeah. So, like I said, I believe we had, I don't remember if we had just recorded done that first session and then the Spin article happened, but basically, she was flying from LA. I think I can't remember. She's flying from LA back to Kansas. But she was in the plane when she saw the Spin article, and she like, I'm going to call these guys. And she somehow got my number. I think she ended up calling my apartment from the plane.
Oh my God.
And, I wasn't home, and Bob picked up the phone. And so she talked to Bob, and the next thing you know, Bob's telling me, I just talked to this girl, Sunshine. She's going to sign us to a contract. And I'm like, what? You know, what are you talking about? All of that was in the aftermath of the Spin article. And then sure enough, she flew to Minneapolis, and we ended up signing with Fiasco Records. And she then paid for the second session in August of 93.
Okay.
And we went back and recorded like 5 more songs, and then finished everything, mixed it, and all done in August, August of 93.
Okay. So I've got before we go on any further, I have a question about something I saw. I did see a Bleeding Hearts song on an album, Swingin' Party, a musical nod to the Replacements. That came out in 97.
Oh, yeah.
Was that part of those sessions, or was that something that happened after? Was that recorded with Bob or after he had passed?
That was after. Yeah, and that was after he had passed. I think that was a benefit.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was a live, that was like a live show that got recorded and released.
Okay. Okay.
So yeah, that was post Bob. And it was separate from the sessions. But yeah, that's cool that you saw that.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsors.
Hey guys, I want to talk to you about socks for a second. Why not? It's a music podcast. But I tried a pair of socks from Boldfoot and love them. I've only worn them once because my kids have stolen them. So in my household, that's the best endorsement I can give. And I guess it's fitting because the design I chose was jailbait. Wait, jailbird. The design I chose was jailbird. I might keep that in. The socks are 100% American made and 5% of all proceeds go to veteran charities. It makes sense, seeing that Boldfoot is a family and veteran-owned company. They have a huge variety of styles. So check out boldfoot.com and buy some of the best socks you've ever slapped on your feet. And help veterans while you're at it. That's boldfoot.com.
Now, was the Riches to Rags, I guess the two sessions combined, was that your first experience in the studio, or had you done stuff before that?
Actually, no. So the Bleeding Hearts had done a 3-song demo. Probably it was probably 91, early 91.
Okay.
And that was at Underground Studios, which was at that time was owned by Tommy Roberts. And we did that with drummer Bob's older brother, Tommy, or Tom. Tom Herbers recorded that.
Oh, cool.
Everyone's a Tom or a Bob.
Yeah, I know that. We got so Bob's and Rob's.
We kind of like... Yeah, right. So we made and that was kind of, we never released that either. That was kind of more demo-ish quality. But yeah, and then when I approached Tommy Roberts about doing the record at that point, he was engineering it and producing at Terrarium.
Oh, okay.
That studio is still going, actually. It's in a different location now, but it's a really it's a really nice studio. So I think it's a it was really well recorded for sure.
Oh yeah. Yeah. But after the sessions, Bob was out of the band pretty soon after that though. What happened?
Let's see. I think if you go through the timeline, we were kind of roommates, bandmates, for probably approaching like a year and a half. And, it could be sort of volatile at times. Bob had his demons,
Yeah.
I was only like 21, 22 years old, Oh, wow. So I was whatever. And, in the beginning it was great, Bob was really into it, and we used to practice like 2 or 3 times a week, and I think as a band we got really tight, and we had a lot of good times. But I think over the course of a year and a half of just kind of trying to keep Bob away from bad elements, and it was kind of like the dual job of being band leader and babysitter.
Yeah.
It got to be a little intense. And, I think he moved out of my apartment. We had gotten into a few fights,
yeah.
A couple of physical updates. And then he moved out. And then at that point, I think the last straw was we were playing a show at the 7th Street Entry, and he went and got the payment for the show and then took off. And, it's like, what? When I found out Bob took the money for the show and left, I was pretty pissed off, So,
oh yeah. Well, right on the show.
Yeah. So, that was kind of the final straw, we ended up, this was probably the fall of 93 and Sunshine had gotten us books for the CMJ, you know, music festival or whatever in New York. And we went and did that, but we had to have John Freeman from the Magnolias fill in for Bob. So that kind of took this, you know, the steam out of the, you know, out of it, where it was, I think, a big part of the, you know, initial attraction to releasing the record for her was probably, you know, having Bob Stinson on this record. And so once he was out of the band, you know, it just kind of got put on the back burner.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, but you kept the band going for a little while after that, though.
Yeah. I mean, I guess you brought it up that, I guess that 97, we were still going as the Bleeding Hearts.
And then, yeah.
And then, at some point we decided to change the name, and we ended up changing the name to, became F5 for a while.
Okay.
But yeah, probably up, I don't know, till around 98, I think it is kind of when it ended. I had joined the Magnolias and shortly after Bob left the group too.
Right.
This would have been like 93, 94. So,
okay.
Yeah.
So you're still playing music. You're in the Magnolias, and you know, you've also played, it looks, now to me, I'm looking at this, it looks like you played on a song by Static Taxi. Is that right? We Do?
Oh yeah, that happened when, you know, when Bob was living at my place. They came back and approached him about playing on the song, and they were for some reason I ended up hitting it off with those guys and also ended up playing on it too. Yeah. So
all right, so you've done Static Taxi, you joined the Magnolias. You've also played in Blame, the Red Flags, Jay Peterson, but there's always these Bleeding Heart sessions with Bob Stinson that they've gone unheard. What happened to them? Did Fiasco just hold on to him, and you guys had no idea that they were still around? I'm just curious as to how something gets hidden or forgotten about for like 29 years.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, actually another tidbit too is funny is that when we were recording that, well, Riches to Rags, and actually even before we were recording that in the studio, Slim Dunlap used to come by and you know, he came down to our practice space one time when and recorded a bunch of songs of at our practice, and was always really really supportive of Bob, you know, super nice. Yeah. And then after Bob with Stinson was out of the band, we did another three song little whatever recording, and Slim actually helped out on that one.
Cool.
That one we just kind of, that was sort of self-released. I think we put that out on cassette. This is probably like 95.
That's coming back.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, in 94, the Magnolias moved to Boston for a little while, and then we came back after like 6 months. We actually ended up moving into a house that Sunshine had rented in South Minneapolis. And so like we were kind of all under the same roof, and you know, we were talking about releasing it then. I remember, you know, the last few times I run into Bob, you know, I ran into Bob one time. He was sitting by Lake of the Isles, and he had like a Walkman with a cassette of the Bleeding Hearts record.
Oh, wow.
And he was like, I don't, you know, she should just put this out, you know? So, I mean, I know that we had the record was, you know, mixed, it was mastered. I had this guy, Doug Wild, master it. So, I mean, it was ready to go. You know, it's just, I don't know why it didn't just come out then, but I guess to fast forward a few years, Sunshine and I remained in contact. And at one point, I can't remember, it probably was the early, early 2000s, she gave me the master tapes back.
Oh wow!
I can't remember. So I had the I still have the masters here. And then during that time, you know, over the last few years, she's been saying, "Oh, I'm gonna, you know, we still got to get this out." So I mean, it was never like no one ever forgot about it. You know,
oh, it's that's just good.
The question really is, you know, it's more a matter of how quickly 29 years, 25, you know, a quarter of a century it can go by, you know, pretty yeah. quick. And, you know, I think, you know, maybe the whole break with the pandemic kind of gave people a time to kind of get things like that done, you know.
Yeah, get old projects.
Yeah, so she was on. Yeah, right. So yeah, so she got a and there she told me a few times, you know, leading up to where she connected with the guys at Bar None, that they're, you know, she, you know, I could tell it was getting kind of, you know, it was getting, she was getting warmer, you know, it was like, she's like kind of, I'm talking to so-and-so and this and that. And then finally, all of a sudden, boom, Bar None's going to put it out. I was like, oh, okay, great. You know, and it would have actually probably, I think it was initially, I think the initial goal was for it to come out in the 2020. We're in 2022 now.
Yeah.
I think it was initially intended to come out last year's Record Store Day, but then with the, you know, with supply chain and stuff.
The vinyl. Yeah.
Yeah. You need like, I think you need more than 6 months lead time for vinyl now, I think.
Yeah.
Is what it is. I'd say it probably took more than 6 months from the time we, you know, sent the master to go. And you know, then we got a test. I think we got a test print in maybe like November, December.
Oh, wow.
And then I just got a copy of it myself, the final record, like last week.
Oh my God. So, I
mean, that's how long it, you know, just getting it pressed.
Jeez.
You know, but I should have said it takes 30 years to get it, you know, we sent it to the record press in 1993 and just happened to come back
29 years later,
2022.
Hey, see, you know, people complain about a 6 month wait. You've had 29 years. I don't want to hear anything from anybody else. Well, I really got into the album. It's really cool. I mean, all right, so the title track, Riches to Rags, is really good. I like that a lot. That's an awesome track. What Do You Want is killer. I love that. But I think my favorite is Imagination. That is my favorite track. It kind of sounds like my favorite era Stones, like Sticky Fingers, Exile era Stones. That I kind of get that feel from that song. I think that's why I like that the best.
Yeah, no, that's definitely got the, those two in particular, probably the, you know, have the Stonesiest vibe. Yeah. I mean, kind of looking back at that time frame, Imagination is, is one that just kind of, it almost seems kind of foreign to me now. Like,
really?
How I wrote that, you know, and whatever, you know, it's kind of got like a Hot Legs kind of Rod Stewart, you know, kind of feel.
I didn't think of that.
But yeah. Yeah. And Bob kind of put his stamp on that one. He's the one that whistles at the beginning of it.
Oh, okay. Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah.
So how long did it had it been since you actually sat down and listened to the music before, you know, Sunshine was like, oh, you know, we're going to put it out. I mean, you said it wasn't lost or forgotten about, but had you heard it at all recently?
I mean, like you said, it wasn't lost. I actually had a master CD that was, you know, from the mastering session that would have been the CD that we would have used, you know, to send to go get it produced or replicated. So it's funny. I had a copy of it. It's funny. A bunch of people had copies of it. You know, over the years, it kind of leaked out, my immediate circle of friends. So it was kind of, in a weird way, it was kind of like all my friends had it, you know, so we could talk about it and everyone kind of knew it, you know, in this tiny little bubble. But so, you know, and then, you know, there would, the Magnolias have done, you know, we'll do some of that. Couple of those songs here and there. And,
oh, cool.
The Red Flags did a couple of the songs as well. It's like, and yeah. So, and of course, when it became, you know, known that we were going to put it out with Bar None, we did some work, you know, this would have been a little over, like over a year ago now, but we had one of the masters bounce to digital so we could do some remixing and some work like that on it.
Okay.
Yeah. So I was involved, you know, that's when I kind of, you know, got to hear the original raw material, again, and that's also where we kind of discovered a lost track, which I had forgotten that we'd recorded. So there was an additional song, that we found on the master that was forgotten about.
Oh man.
And that got added. That got added on to the records.
So. Oh, which track was that?
Know It All. It's on side two.
Okay. That's really cool. So there were surprises.
Yeah. Yeah, there were definitely surprises. Because I knew there was another, I remember this other track that we recorded that I knew wasn't finished. And then I discovered Know It All was on there and it was like, oh wow, there's vocals on here. Everything. I had overdubbed a guitar solo. I mean, so like everything was there. I don't know why we didn't mix that one. For some reason, I think there was something about it I wasn't happy with at the time, but then hearing it 25 to 29 years later, I was, you know,
a little more forgiving.
I don't know. Yeah. I was like, it's fine. You know, sounds good to me.
Yeah. So when there's a 29 year gap between the recording and the release of an album, and one of the members has passed away and the band isn't actually active, what do you do when the album actually comes out? I mean, are you planning on playing any of this live with Magnolias? Are you planning on putting together a version of Bleeding Hearts and playing some of this live? Are there any plans for anything like that?
Well, actually, it's funny that, so Pat McKenna, the drummer in the Bleeding Hearts, he joined the Magnolias about, well, let's see. Oh, God, it's probably almost been 10 years now. Yeah, so Pat McKenna from the Bleeding Hearts is now in the Magnolias. I'm in the Magnolias, and then Rob Ribello, the Bleeding Hearts bass player. So we've the three of us started getting together and playing. I don't know, about 8 months ago.
Oh, cool.
And then recently decided, well, we might as well get John Freeman to come back and play some rhythm guitar. So it's kind of like three quarters Magnolias and then half Bleeding Hearts.
Oh, that's great.
But yeah, we're playing a show on Record Store Day. So we have that in the works, and I don't know, you know, beyond that, we'll just kind of wait and see. I guess anything could happen.
Yeah.
But it's good to kind of have the material in the wheelhouse again, you know, so we can break it out anytime.
Yeah. And you know, now that the music's out, you don't have to sit there and think, what if anymore? What if this album came out? How, you know, it's out now. People can actually hear it outside of your close knit friends that had an official bootleg copy of it.
Right. Yeah. Very cool.
Well, man, look, I've kept you for quite a while. This has been just fascinating. This stories like this just blow me away. I'm so intrigued by how this stuff happens, how things get recorded and then just either put on the back burner or sometimes completely forgotten about for so many years. Somebody stumbles upon it and boom, hey, we should put this out. So this is just really amazing. It's such an amazing story. And I want. Where can people pick up the album? How can they hear it and follow Bleeding Hearts to see when you guys do play some live shows?
Yeah, it was just actually funny. I just put up the event page for that show, and I was like, oh, I remember the Bleeding Hearts had a MySpace page
back in the day.
So I'm probably gonna have to like update the social media presence of the Bleeding Hearts at some point here, but but as far as how to find the record, now the record of course is a limited release, you know. Mm-hmm. I think it's like 3,200 wow, worldwide on limited edition red vinyl. Ooh. So I mean, you know, to get the record, you gotta find a participating Record Store Day record store that has it.
Ooh, it's a hunt.
But my understanding is all the records are gone. I mean, are out to are distributed to the stores. It looks like Rough Trade is, you know, saying that you can go online. If you search it online, you know, any inventory that's not sold after Record Store Day, I think you can order online.
Okay.
Is what it said. And then, you know, hopefully bar none there'll be a digital release a couple months after Record Store Day. So Record Store Day is April 23rd. And then I don't know if it's in June or July. It should have a digital release.
Oh, excellent.
Then in the summer. And then hopefully we'd like to, you know, we'd love to see Bar None, you know, do another pressing. You know, I imagine if, you know, another pressing were done, it would be on just regular black vinyl.
Yeah.
I don't know about CDs anymore.
I know. that kills me. I have like 3,500 of them in my house. I was a big CD collector. I still am.
Yeah.
I still love CDs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, you don't get the big art like you do with vinyl, but you can play them in your car. Well, you used to be able to. I can't anymore. I got a car, a 2018 Jeep, and it doesn't even have a CD player.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I just got to use a USB stick. Yeah, everything's now streaming, or I got to put everything on a USB, on like a thumb drive.
Oh, wow. New cars don't come with CD players anymore.
No, mine didn't, at least.
Wow.
Kill me. I have a
2008 Jeep Wrangler, and it had a great stereo. I had to replace the stereo a couple years ago.
Oh man, but, playing Bleeding Hearts.
So I have a CD player.
I got a 2018 Compass and it's nothing. It's all streaming or, you know, aux inputs. So I got all kinds of stuff on a USB, bunch of USB drives and play it that way, which that's not as fun. It is available.
So you haven't heard it on vinyl?
No, I haven't. And unfortunately, I have a turntable, but I think my son took it because I don't know where it is. And I don't even know if I have something I can play it on. Any of the vinyl I get is all collectible. I don't really have a whole lot of vinyl that I can play. So I get nervous playing vinyl now. <You know? laughs> I got three kids and two dogs in the house. So I'm afraid to play vinyl. I'm afraid something's going to run into it and scratch it.
Scratch it?
Yeah.
Oh, well, yeah, I've got I had to get this like preamp for my new turntable. And because, you know, like modern day receivers don't tend to not have like phono inputs in them.
Yeah.
And so I had to get this little preamp, and the preamp plays, I mean, the records are playing fine, but it's like at like about half the volume of anything else that I'd play through the receiver. So it's like,
oh wow,
I don't know. I mean, it's not playing at a volume that I would like to listen to a record at.
Yeah,
it's probably loud enough maybe for some people, but I don't know.
My turntable is one of the ones my mom got it for me a couple of years ago because I had some vinyl that I wanted to convert so I could listen to it in my car. It was stuff that I just hadn't been put out on CD or digitally or anything like that. And it's before I knew how to pull stuff off of YouTube and all. But it's a USB, but I don't know the quality really. I just I don't know. I haven't used it in a while. So like I said, I think my son has it. He's into all old tech. Mm. He's got a stereo system that he built up from some parts, and it's all like from the 70s. And so he cracks me up. So when I was growing up and I got my first car, I was like, I just want a V8. I want a big engine, and I want to just tear ass around town. My son, his requirement was, I want a cassette player. Okay.
In the car?
Yeah. So we found a 99 Chrysler Sebring, and it had CD and cassette, and he's thrilled.
So, that's funny.
Well, I want to thank you. I know I've kept you for over an hour at this point, I believe. So thank you so much for spending all this time with me and telling me this amazing story. This is just, like I said before, this is just, it's such a wild story that stuff gets put on hold for almost 30 years. It blows me away.
it blows me away too.
Yeah. Waiting 30 years kind of sucks.
But, well, you know, at least we're still here, I guess.
Yeah, exactly.